Welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. Online and on KBIA, I'm Ruben Stern. Lawmakers continue to investigate a failed deal for the company Mamtech to build an artificial sweetener factory in the city of Moberly. Over the course of 2 days, at the end of November, a House committee heard testimony from local and state officials about how the deal came to be and what happened along the way before the company went belly up. One big question is this: why did the city of Moberly issue $39 million in bonds on behalf of a company that may not have ever produced a single ounce of the product it claimed to be making in China? Given the pressure to create jobs and get the economy rolling again, the deal probably seemed like a good deal at the time, and therein lies the challenge. Did the state and the city of Moberly exercise the proper due diligence into Mamtech's claims? And if not, then whose responsibility should it have been to do that? And what might be done to prevent this sort of thing from happening to other communities in the future? With us in the studio to help sort out the twists and turns of this saga so far, Benjamin Harold is the city editor of the Moberly Monitor Index newspaper. Welcome to the program, Benjamin Harold.
Hi, good to be here.
Glad to have you with us today as well. Hopefully we'll get this all straightened out and figure out what's been going on. Also to help us do that is Rudy Keller. He is a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune. He's been covering the Mamtech story since he broke the story earlier this year. Welcome to the program, Rudy Keller.
Hello, Ruben. How are you doing today?
Great, and we're really glad to have you with us as well.
Well, I'm glad to be here to help people understand this very complex story.
Fantastic. Also with us on the phone, we have Tina Hoffman. She is the communications director for the Iowa Economic Development Authority and hopefully can give us some perspective about how state agencies approach this sort of situation. Tina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We also hope that we will hear from you and our audience as well. What questions do you have about the Mamtech deal or about government economic incentives in general? Feel free to give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this. Benjamin, I'm going to start with you. For people who haven't been paying close attention to this, how would you briefly summarize what went on here?
Okay, that's a good challenge there. But just to briefly summarize it up, the city of Moberly was trying to bring an artificial sweetener factory to Moberly. They had contacts with a company that supposedly had Chinese origins and then was wanting to expand operations in the United States. They heard about it through the Department of Economic Development, and then they eventually decided to issue $39 million in municipal bonds, annual appropriations bonds, to finance the project, and it kind of was going along. There was some construction done at the site, and then in September it came out that the company, Mamtech, was out of money and wouldn't be able to make the bond payments. Just pretty much that.
Any important details to add to that, Rudy Keller?
Well, the important thing that it really focused everyone's attention on was when the company was unable to make the bond payments and the construction halted, then things started rattling loose in this project. The construction companies were owed $1.5 million. There are all sorts of vendors that are owed money. It pointed out that maybe people had not paid a lot of attention to what was the underpinnings of the private capital portion of this company when they were so eager to get jobs when this company came to Missouri in the beginning of 2010. And that's where the story has developed over time, is all the aspects of this, of what should people have checked and what did they miss and why did it end up in a situation where Moberly has now had its bond rating cut and the bonds have plummeted in value to, say, 30 cents on the dollar, if anybody will ever get any money back out of them.
Right. And why is the government of the state of Missouri investigating all of this?
Well, that's because there were $39 million of local bonds. There were $17.6 million of state tax credits and other incentives that were promised to the project. It was the kind of project that the governor loves to go out and announce that he's bringing to the state of Missouri. And it was supposed to be 600 jobs in a community of about 13,000 people. That's enough jobs for about 5% of the people in Moberly. That's a huge impact for that community if it came to pass. And so what people wanted to know was why was this such a colossal failure in terms of determining who whether the private financing that was promised to be there, which was supposed to back up the public financing and which the public financing was supposed to supplement, where was it? Why didn't it show up? And who was responsible for making a decision to fund a startup, essentially a startup company?
Right, which wasn't presented as such, but in the end, sort of.
No,
that's
when it was, right? When it was started, it was presented as an ongoing multinational company making sucralose, an artificial sweetener in China, and that it was already selling large amounts of this material from the Chinese factory, but wanted to expand to the United States.
Right. We'll come back to some of those details, I'm sure, as this conversation goes forward. I want to bring Tina in. Now, Tina, you work for an agency in Iowa that looks at these kinds of things and helps support efforts to create jobs in the state of Iowa. We tried to extend an invitation to Missouri's Department of Economic Development to join us. They declined our invitation for that. But Tina, I'm wondering if you could give a little bit of the state perspective on this. What sort of stuff usually goes into a deal like this in terms of the state eyes on a deal like this?
Well, I can only talk about what kinds of things we do here in the state of Iowa, but
of course,
our agency, you know, we do have a pretty extensive due diligence process that we go through, not only our staff, but then we have a board made up of business leaders from around the state who, you know, run their own businesses, have served on bank boards, those kinds of things, and they do another level of due diligence as well. So, you know, we do spend a lot of time on the front end looking at these projects and making sure that all of the elements are in place. Some of the things that we do, of course, after determining if a project meets the program requirements of the program that we're thinking of, you know, we actually go so far as to look at the do some research on the company, look at external resources like Hoover's and Dun & Bradstreet, those kinds of things, as well as different state agencies, our Department of Transportation, for example, Department of Natural Resources. Just looking for, is the company in good standing, not only with other state agencies that they might be doing business with, but just in general, you know, what is that third party saying about these companies that we're looking to incentivize to bring jobs to the state?
And is there a standardized form that gets filled out, or a standardized sort of route for all of this due diligence work that you just mentioned in terms of where that information goes and who gets it and what's gathered?
Well, we do have an application for financial assistance or tax assistance through our agency, and so the components of the project are laid out in that application. That would include information on the company's financials, which, of course, is something that we're looking at as we get farther down the road, specifically the budget of the project. You know, how is that project being financed? What element is from the company or investors? Is that committed? Is it in already? Those kinds of things that all, of course, play into what our board ultimately decides to do in terms of financial assistance to bring a project to the state.
Okay, let me remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the investigation into the failed MamTech project in Moberly. Joining me in the studio are Benjamin Harold, city editor of the Moberly Monitor Index, and Rudy Keller, a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune. Also with us by phone is Tina Hoffman, marketing and communications director for the Iowa Economic Development Authority. For those of you in our audience, whose responsibility do you think it should be to investigate companies that are looking to get support from the government to create jobs? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We'd also like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Tina, just another question about the process there in Iowa. How long does that typically take for all of that due diligence to be done?
Well, you know, that really depends. There is, of course, the phase prior to the application where we might be competing with other states to bring that project to our state. or expansions, as the case may be, with local industries that are looking to add a line or add another product or that kind of thing. So there's that whole sales process, which can take anywhere from 6 months, probably at the short end, to years, I think, in some cases. But after, you know, the project has been, after it's kind of narrowed down the focus and the scope, once we have an application in hand, that typically, you know, can run probably 30 to 60 days, I would say, is an estimate.
Mm-hmm. And what's typically done to verify the information that the companies give you?
Well, again, our finance team, who is particularly adept at these kinds of things, are looking at financials. So not only our staff, but then again, as I mentioned, the board members who are business leaders from around the state who have been appointed to the board because of the expertise that they bring to the table, they also confidentially review those financials. We have conversations back and forth with you know, perhaps the bank that's involved in the investment, certainly the company, and in many cases the community, because one of the tenets of the financial assistance that we do from the state is that the locals have to be on board and that the locals have to be supportive of a project like this. So a board policy of ours is to always have local match in these projects.
Okay. Rudy and Benjamin, how does that compare with what went on the MamTech situation?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting she points out seems that, at least up there in Iowa, that it's big to have communication between the local economic development officials and the state, and that may be the ideal in the case here in the Show Me State. I do think the one thing that came out at the hearings the House committee had in Jefferson City was that there was a bit of a disconnect between what the local economic development officials were saying and then what the state-level people were saying. So I feel like that communication, you know, kind of like joining each other in the process of checking that out is something that I thought was interesting.
Yeah, it did seem as though that Moberly was relying on the professionals that would be making money off of the bond issue to do the background checks on MamTech in some instances, and the state. If you look at some of the materials that the state collected, like there's a financial statement from MamTech, and all it is a month-by-month attempt to show what the revenues that they expected were. It doesn't say where the revenue was to come from, whether it was to come from sales or investments. It doesn't say exactly where the initial starting balance of about $8 million was supposed to come from. It did indicate that they expected to be up and running in 3 months selling sucralose, and it was 15 months after they started, after they announced the project, when it died and without any completed factory. The state due diligence in this, they did some of the things that Tina described, looked at Dun & Bradstreet, got a financial statement, got applications that said they had $8 million. It just doesn't seem as though they went much beyond MamTech's statements as to what they had. It just that, you know, accepted many of the company's statements at face value. And that seems to be where some of the breakdown was. For example, this past summer, when they were trying to finalize a community development block grant of $2 million. That's federal funds that the state of Missouri controls. It was supposed to be money to either equip the factory or complete the infrastructure for the factory. The state of Missouri was starting what they called a new due diligence process, and they wanted a long list of names of people for criminal background and financial background checks. My questions always were, and they were never adequately answered to my satisfaction, was why are you asking for all this information in the summer of 2011? Wouldn't it have been better to know this information in the spring of 2010? Because wouldn't that inform you as to whether you wanted to even make this company an offer? Mm-hmm. And So that really was puzzling as to who did they actually check out in terms of individuals who were behind the company prior to offering them state incentives and local incentives.
Benjamin, what's your take in terms of the, you know, who was asking questions and who should have been asking questions around all of this?
Well, I mean, that's kind of an interesting question. I always would like to take a little bit broader approach and always have, I mean, if the local community, like Tina said, needs to be behind it, I would like to see the local economic development people kind of working with the state officials on that. And I mean, I think the state has more resources than the local officials will have. I don't think anyone would argue that. They have supposedly contacts in China, you know, actual people there, boots on the ground, so to speak. So I think the state in that regard has more capacity for that. But then I think you have to involve the local community, because in almost all of these cases, the local community provides some sort of incentives. So I feel like for them to know what they want to offer, what they're getting into, I think the local community needs to be involved as well, kind of in that background check research area.
Right. Well, let me throw that back to Tina. Tina, what does the state do and what does the local sort of set of officials do in a typical scenario up in Iowa? Like, how much of the responsibility is taken on by the people at the state level as opposed to the local officials involved?
Well, I think it's important to begin the answer to that question with, you know, at the end of the day, the goal is the same, is to try to attract companies that can be successful and can create jobs. So, I mean, certainly from our agency, I mean, we, you know, it's a fine line between promoting the state and bringing those companies here and then also doing the due diligence that's necessary to make sure those things can be as successful as possible. I mean, there certainly are always factors that are outside of everyone's control, but, you know, the goal is the same. You know, I can't really speak to what kind of local due diligence is done. Every project is different. Every community is different. But certainly, you know, in most cases, at least for the projects we're working on, city councils or county boards of supervisors are making these dollar amounts. They're, you know, either providing tax benefits or, in some cases, direct assistance, just like our board is doing on behalf of the state. So I think that, you know, each of those entities has fiduciary responsibility and probably needs to do its own level of due diligence, although I certainly agree with what Benjamin said. I mean, in a lot of cases here in Iowa, we have more resources and more staff availability to do some of those things than some of our local communities do. So, I mean, we certainly try to do our part of it, but I think whenever you've got dollars in, you know, it's your responsibility to be doing some due diligence as well.
Okay. Let me remind our audience once again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the failed MamTech project in Moberly. Joining me in the studio are Benjamin Harold, city editor of the Moberly Monitor Index, and Rudy Keller, a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune. Also with us by phone is Tina Hoffman, Marketing and Communications Director for the Iowa Economic Development Authority. For those of you in our audience, what do you think individual communities could do to minimize risk to taxpayers while still supporting the creation of jobs? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Rudy, you want to weigh in here?
I have a question for Tina. I was wondering if communities in Iowa on a regular basis borrow money in order to support these kind of projects, or is it more of a situation where you just don't collect certain kinds of taxes like property taxes that would be imposed on a big new development in order to help these companies?
Again, it's kind of on a project-by-project basis. Typically, I mean, we do see things like tax abatements. There might be certain TIF financing for locating in specific areas, although I would say, at least in the projects we're involved in, which are our non-retail projects, it would be not common for a community to kind of go out and bond for that kind of dollar amount for one project specifically.
And that's where that some of the biggest questions in the legislature are being raised are these bond issues. The $39 million that Moberly borrowed is money that is allowed under state industrial revenue acts. And the Revenue Bond Acts. And what they – the companies that all made like $686,000 of the $39 million, money that came right off the top and was never put into the project – what they did was that they looked at what Moberly's credit rating was. How well has Moberly paid its bonds back in the past? They didn't look at MamTech and say, is this company creditworthy? It's much like you or me, if we go apply for a platinum Visa card and they see we haven't paid our student loans and have had a car repossessed, they aren't going to give it to us. But if you ask, they ask. But if your parents, who have always paid their mortgage on time and have always paid their car payments on time and always paid their credit card bills on time, say, "We want you to lend money so that," then that's what the companies did. And so there's some legislators who are determined that they're going to put additional pressure on these companies that make large amounts as a percentage of the bond issue to prepare much better examinations of the companies behind the projects. Now, there are communities that have borrowed money for Ford or Chrysler or Procter & Gamble in Missouri, but if a company like Procter & Gamble isn't paying its bonds and because it's not selling enough diapers and it's this 100-year-old company, the country's in a lot worse shape than what some one community is dealing with some bonds.
Right.
But so it's when you deal with a startup company that you're putting a lot of your community's credit rating and trustworthiness on the line that you have to be especially careful.
Yeah, I want to bring a caller in. We have a caller from Columbia. Joyce, are you with us?
I am. Yeah.
Terrific. Thanks for joining the program and for calling in today.
Yeah, I've been trying to make sense of this since I got first notice of it.
You and many people in our community, I suspect.
Yeah, and it strikes me that the question I have anyhow, I'm getting a feedback on this.
Sorry about that.
Was MamTech a shill company or anything real?
Okay, I'm going to let our panelists respond to that, and we'll go ahead and take you offline to reduce that feedback, if that's all right.
Thank you.
Okay, so is MamTech a real company or what?
Well, just to jump in, I mean, to be totally fair, they had the hearings down there for 2 days in Jefferson City, and they didn't know yet for sure whether MamTech had a factory in China. We have an email from a guy in China who says he did internet research. I'm sure we're all aware China's internet is heavily censored. But a guy who did internet research claims that the factory never opened, never began production. Obviously, the MamTech people, attorneys hired by MamTech, said, yes, it's running, but there was never any third-party confirmation that there was a facility in China.
In like a lot of companies these days, there are the structure is not direct. And the disclosure of who's involved in a company is not direct. There is a thing called MamTech International Incorporated. It's registered in Hong Kong. The address that it's registered at in Hong Kong, we learned in the legislative hearings, is just a business center. You know, think UPS store with a post office box. Then there's MamTech U.S. Incorporated. That was a corporation formed in Delaware. And then when you form a corporation in Delaware, all you have to do is sign a piece of paper, and it can be somebody who doesn't have any ownership in the property at all or the company at all who is the incorporator of that company. Then you had another company that was formed in Missouri called MamTech Regional Center Incorporated, and that was supposed to be a conduit for Chinese investments through a program called the EB-5 Immigrant Investor Visa Program. And all of these separate companies have ownership that is difficult to determine. As MamTech International Incorporated in Hong Kong has the most extensive list of ownership that has become public. But if you translate the Hong Kong dollar investments into U.S. dollars that are reported in their filing, they had about $13,000 in capital.
Right. Well, I want to bring Tina back in. Tina, could this happen in Iowa? I mean, how what are the basic strengths or background or legitimacy claims that a company has to have in order to qualify for state incentives?
Well, I would say that, again, because of the boards that we have put in place and because of their particular expertise, oftentimes, you know, what happens if a board, one of our board members is reviewing a project, they'll say, oh, those sales sound too good to be true. In my experience, you know, it might not be in the same industry, but, you know, business people with a certain acumen, I think, can look at those kinds of projections and say, tell me how that's going to happen, because that doesn't make sense for me, or I can't straighten that in my head. So those kinds of questions, I think, are particularly what are helpful to us, because it's that different experience that is at the table that allows us to ask different kinds of questions. As far as protecting the state's interests go, once an award is made from our board's perspective, then we go into a contracting phase directly with the company, and collateral is a major part of anything that that we're putting out there. So we have, you know, either UCCs or dedicated CDs or an irrevocable letter of credit, or in some cases with a startup, you know, personal or corporate guarantees that we put in place for any kind of direct assistance that's on the table, so that if something does happen with a company, that the state is protected with its investment and can get those dollars back.
And what about a situation where it's a future tax break? Because that's what went on here, as Missouri said they were going to give tax breaks against income in the future when the company was rolling.
Sure. Well, you know, I assume like in Missouri, in Iowa, you can't take a tax credit if you haven't paid taxes in, or if you don't have a tax liability, for example. So in some cases where it sounds like with this project where it was early on, no tax credits were given to the company because they didn't have a tax liability to begin with. So the state in that situation isn't out. I mean, they certainly aren't getting, the revenues from the having the company be in place. But, it isn't a case where they're out something that has to be repaid. In the case of the state of Iowa, if a project is going along, for example, and we have issued tax credits and they are able to take some of those tax credits, but then at the end of the project we find that they haven't perhaps created the jobs that they expected to create for some reason and they might owe the state back, then we actually work with the Department of Revenue to go back and get those tax credits back. The company then has to pay the taxes that they didn't pay previously.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the MamTech project in Moberly and what happened with that. Joining me in the studio are Benjamin Harold, city editor of the Moberly Monitor, and Rudy Keller, a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune. Joining us by phone is Tina Hoffman, marketing and communications director for the Iowa Economic Development Authority. And we unfortunately have to say goodbye to Tina at this point, but our other guests are going to stick around. Tina, thanks for joining us today. And we'll be right back after a short break. Stick around. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the failed MamTech project in Moberly. Joining me in the studio are Benjamin Harold, city editor of the Moberly Monitor Index, and Rudy Keller, a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune who initially broke the story last spring. For those of you in our audience, how well do you think officials have responded to MamTech's failure? Also, if you are one of the residents of Moberly and would like to join our conversation, we hope you'll share your thoughts by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. In the first half of the program, we talked a little bit about the specifics of what went on and how that compares with what other states might do. You know, one of the questions that we were talking about over the break, and I think is a good one, is, so what happened here? I mean, are there crooks involved, or is this just a deal that didn't work out?
Well, we found out when the deal went sour that the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States has been investigating this for several months. We have other investigations that have begun since the news came out that that was a problem, but the what the bank trustee for the bonds revealed was that the Securities and Exchange Commission has been investigating this. So we don't know whether or not this was a crooked deal where people were deliberately trying to rip off the taxpayers of Missouri, or whether it was just a very, very bad idea from a business standpoint in the first place. I've talked to an engineering firm from Kansas City who said that the process that they had planned to use was a flawed process that would never have worked, would never have met OSHA standards, and the entire plant had to be re-engineered from the design that they started with, and that they bought lots of equipment that then became useless because of the re-engineering. Now, if that wasted so much money that they, because they were so eager to do this quickly, that they just started spending money right away, well, then it's just a bad businessmen. Well, whether or not these guys were crooked is going to have to be determined by investigators who have a higher pay grade than me. So we're learning about that in fits and starts, and I'm eager for these investigations to start revealing what is – it's difficult from someone sitting in central Missouri to find out from China or California or other places where these people operate.
Right. Benjamin, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, just to jump in there, and I think Rudy's right with these investigations going on. I don't think we can quite say yet whether or not it was just bad business or perhaps something more nefarious than that. Talking just with different business consultants, they've mostly to me said things like it seems like these people are maybe a little naive or wet behind the ears or don't understand all that goes in, you know, to starting up a business. Obviously, a pretty complicated thing, but I think with all these investigations going on, you know, you've got the attorney general working with the county prosecuting attorney, obviously the House and Senate looking into it, and then the big one, the Securities and Exchange Commission. I think, you know, I'm anxious to see, but I think it's kind of a wait and see approach on that regard right now.
Who would be the person or people that would be in question here? I mean, is it people in Moberly? Is it the person, Bruce Cole, who was in charge of the company?
Okay,
what's going on?
The principal people in MamTech were a man named Bruce Cole, who is a Beverly Hills, California businessman, and some other people from Beverly Hills, including a former president of the Beverly Hills, California School Board. And these people are not naive about China. They're not naive about business. Bruce Cole's name shows up on several other companies in addition to MamTech. And Bruce Cole had a deal that I found that through the Beverly Hills City Council to have exchanges of people and tourism with China. Bruce Cole is very familiar with China. The other names on the MamTech International Inc. list that is registered in Hong Kong are people with Chinese – with addresses in mainland China. So if there's anything – if there's a crooked dealer in this, it's going to – it probably is going to be among those people. But that's yet to be determined because Bruce Cole came to the came to Moberly after the thing collapsed and tried to create a new company, tried to promise that he would get the thing started again, get some money to Moberly to pay their expenses, and just was unable to do that. He got a little bit of that done, but it fell apart on him again. So if that's you can view that in two ways. One could be that's a good faith effort to try to save a project that you'd put your heart and soul into but just didn't work. Or it's a subterfuge to divert people's attention until you finally get them off your trail.
And is it likely that we're going to find out which of the two things you just described that may be?
Probably sometime next year. That's a pretty good bet considering it's halfway through December. Now, whether it's 2013 we find that out or not. And I've been through stories like this before where you just aren't sure whether somebody was a bad actor or whether somebody was just unlucky. And in that case, it took many years to get some finality in my mind as to whether the person was a bad actor. It was 7 years down the road in one case of a story. So, when or exactly we're going to find that, I sure hope it doesn't take 7 years to find this out.
Although in some cases, that inability to tell whether it's bad actor or just bad decision maker is what makes for good Hollywood films, right?
Well, I have joked to people that this is one car chase away from a great movie, but I've
the wheels of justice turn slowly, for sure,
yeah.
I think.
Well, so in the meantime, what is actually going on with all this? I mean, there's a plot of land that has a partially built factory on it, right?
Yeah. I mean, right now, the land itself, the property, has been secured right after, it came out that Mamtech missed their bond payment. Actually, they hadn't finished the barbed wire fence around it, and you can bet that was done pretty quickly after that. But as of right now, the site's kind of sitting just vacant, so to speak, half-finished somewhere in that neighborhood. And the economic development entity, the local group, is still, pitching the idea to different groups. And they say they've been in contact with two different companies about taking it over. And then also, supposedly, the State Department of Economic Development has a list of the top 20 sucralose manufacturers in the world. And their task after these committees was contact each and every one of them, specific pitch, say, we have this facility, good location, it's kind of just about ready to go, try and make this thing happen. So I think there should be some efforts going on to still keep trying to pitch it, keep trying to make things happen, as far as last I've heard, anyway.
And who owns that land at the moment?
The city owns it, to my understanding, based on the bond documents, although it's technically in default. So, UMB Bank, the trustee, could try and stake a claim to it.
The statement that was made when the final decision by Moberly came to light to not make the payment of $3.2 million, which had to be made up by November 1st in order to restore the bond reserves, was that we're going to turn this project, control the project over to the trustee, UMB Bank. They're kind of like the mortgage holder on your house. But UMB hasn't moved in and announced that they're going to auction off the equipment or started selling the equipment off to recover the funds yet that have been spent. So it's kind of like you're living in your house with the mortgage in foreclosure, and if you came up with a great way to satisfy the bank, they're going to let you stay there, which is kind of what Moberly officials are doing. The way they've described it is one company that they're talking to might operate the plant. One company has offered to liquidate the property. Liquidating the property means, in part, a lot of equipment that is sitting outside right now, getting snowed on and rained on, and is going to go through the winter outside. How much of this equipment is just a steel tank that can take that kind of weather, and how much of it is specialized equipment that the infiltration of water and freezing that is a natural process that you see in everywhere every year where potholes are formed is another question. How much of that stuff can survive a year in the weather?
And is there any sense of that? I mean, has anyone done an inventory of what actually is there and what it might be worth?
I'm sure the bank has. I'm sure that Moberly has a good idea. You can look at the list of things that were purchased with the bond proceeds and get an idea of what's there. But as a reporter, I'm naturally a generalist. I don't know whether a steam boiler tank is something that can be that can stand a year or two in the weather until somebody can use it or not.
And how realistic is it that the Moberly officials or whoever else wants to try to solve this problem would be able to actually go to the banks with a plan that would be acceptable to use your metaphor, Rudy, to keep them in their home? I mean, to keep this project from completely disappearing.
Just to jump in there, I mean, I do think UMB Bank would certainly be receptive to it. So in that sense, the climate's there for it. I mean, as far as whether or not they can find that kind of a deal, I mean, it's obviously a tough economic climate out there, but I do think UMB Bank would be pretty receptive to something like that.
Moberly's decision that came down November 1st was a decision on whether to restore the bond reserves that had been used to make a payment that was due September 1st. There's enough money in the bond reserves to make another interest payment that's due to the bondholders on April 1st. There's not enough money to make the next principal payment, which is due next September. Purely speculation on my part is that if a company with the financial strength and the ability to use this factory moved in, you might see a deal where they say, okay, we need you to be ready to make a bond payment in March. We need you to make the interest payment in March. They may not require them to restore the full $3.2 million taken from the reserves. That might come later. But the idea would be somebody would use it. So I could see a company that has the financial strength to use it getting in there on a relatively inexpensive level. The question is this a profitable business to begin with? The state incentives, the $17.6 million of tax credits and other incentives, those are off the table right now. Those would all have to be reapplied for, and you know that the state is going to be gun shy about providing that big of a package again for the same kind of project.
Yeah, it's probably safe to assume that a little more due diligence would go on this time than last time.
I would say so.
So what happens? You mentioned that there's an interest payment that Moberly is on the hook for in April, then a principal bond payment in the fall. What happens if they don't make those payments?
Well, they aren't really on the hook for them. We're getting into this idea of what kind of bonds we have. They are revenue bonds. In this case, they're called annual appropriation bonds. A revenue bond says on its face, and the investor is supposed to read this print because it's in boldface, it's not a legal debt obligation of the city of Moberly. But these revenue bonds are used all over the state. Columbia's tall garage downtown was built with annual appropriation bonds, revenue bonds. I went by last Thursday, and that place had four decks of empty of cars. If it was entirely based on the revenue that garage could produce, those bonds would never be paid. But the city of Columbia is going to pay those bonds out of its entire parking revenue, and I imagine if the parking revenue fell short, we would make up the difference for a year or two. Other communities used other kinds of debt, but all based on the revenue stream that the project is able to create. So Moberly has decided, and they decided November 1st, that they would not take the money from their taxpayers to pay this off. And so don't expect that Moberly's taxpayers will make that interest payment in the spring, or that Moberly's taxpayers will make next year's principal and interest payment due in September. It will be entirely based on whether or not they get somebody in there operating the factory. And if they don't get somebody in operating the factory, I would expect it to be liquidated at some point. And then that money deposited and the bonds called in, and you get 40 cents or 50 cents or 10 cents on the dollar, whatever money is available and can be recaptured.
So, Benjamin, if that's the way that the bonds are written, then why is the city taking a hit here? I mean, the bonds say it's based on the revenue that's going to come in here. Why is the city having a problem right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is obviously the credit rating factor that comes in here, not to mention, the notoriety that newspapers and media outlets around the state are looking at you and saying, wow, you messed up there. I think on the credit rating side of things, there's two aspects of it. The rating on the actual bonds was lowered from A- to CC. I think that's about five levels, just basically right above junk bonds on these. But then what I think is even more of an issue for the city of Moberly is it's the city's issuer credit rating, which is not just about these bonds. It's this is your credit rating, was lowered two levels, I believe, from an A to a B. And I think that's something that is really important here, because anytime this city, this municipality wants to borrow money to finance something, now it's going to cost them more. You're going to have higher interest rates. We all remember last summer when there was, you know, the big issue about the United States credit rating being dropped a level by S&P, because it's like, well, this is going to have far-reaching effects, cost more money to borrow money, and now that is going to happen to Moberly here. So I think people look at that and they say, you know, you can say we aren't going to make these payments, but there's still long-term effects.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the MamTech project in Moberly and about public deals to create jobs in general. Joining me in the studio are Benjamin Harold, city editor of the Moberly Monitor Index, and Rudy Keller, a reporter from the Columbia Daily Tribune. For those of you in our audience, what lessons do you think could or perhaps should be learned from the MamTech situation? We hope you'll give us a call and share your thoughts on that or any other part of our conversation today, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Now, Benjamin, you talked about the city's credit rating going down slightly. What's the mood in Moberly around that? How upset are people with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it first happened, I would definitely say there was anger out there. I mean, people were upset, and that kind of subsided into more just disappointment with the whole issue. There hasn't been, like, a mass public uprising. There hasn't been people coming to city council meetings and demanding answers. That's still a thin crowd there. But, I mean, I think there has been some disappointment just because it's a tough economic climate everywhere, but especially in Randolph County with the double-digit unemployment and everything. And I think people were excited. They thought here'd be some jobs, you know, 600 jobs eventually was the estimate. When they came out with applications at the Career Center, they got, I think, 3,000 applications just almost right away. I mean, that's the main thing, is just disappointment, because people thought, okay, here's kind of a oasis in the desert, and then it kind of gets yanked away from you. And there have been other projects in Moberly, like a biodiesel facility that were supposed to start production, were mostly or partly built, and then didn't. So I think people are now kind of getting a little gun-shy about things.
Right. Rudy, what's your sense of that?
Well, I think it'll be interesting when – has filing opened for the city council in Moberly?
Not yet.
Not yet. Well, I think that'll be – that may have – where you'll be able to really test the temper of the town, the temperature of the town. Are there going to be people who will challenge these sitting council members who voted for this project? That'll show whether people – and then what are the outcomes of that election? That'll show how much people trust their current government to get the problem fixed.
Right.
I think that it's created a mood in the whole state that is different. I mean, it's within 6 months. This story has transformed the entire attitude of the legislature – about economic development projects. We were on the verge of dedicating $360 million of state tax money to a new air cargo facility at Lambert Airport in St. Louis that was a purely speculative venture. And the legislature was in special session when the story broke about MamTech. And within a few weeks that it had upset the whole rhythm of that special session. And now with these legislative investigations, what you're talking about is not what are we going to do next year to bring jobs to Missouri, but it's what are we going to do next year to protect Missouri taxpayers and protect local taxpayers from the kinds of events that have occurred around MamTech. There are a couple of other high-profile problem children in the Missouri economic development field. There's a thing called Wi-Fi sensors up at Kirksville. And Wi-Fi sensors got a $1 million community development block grant loan that they never made a payment on. Now, that was federal money, but it was handled by the state of Missouri, and the state of Missouri should have known whether or not this was going to be a deal that would pay back this loan. In Cape Girardeau, there was a vision and dental center that the governor went down and announced that the state was going to give large tax incentives for. But within a few weeks, it was revealed that the person who had applied for these incentives had bad checks that they had pleaded guilty to writing in Stoddard County and were on probation. And now, you know, maybe if they were, you know, $100 check to the grocery store that, and the guy, you know, the guy was just short of cash when the check went through, that might have been a different thing. But they were, it was $90,000 of checks dealing with his business, and we're here supporting the guy's business. I'm starting to hear about other things that are worth checking out. That I haven't been able to confirm right now, but the idea that we don't have enough protections in place to keep Missourians from losing their tax dollars in these projects, the amount of money that is going out in these tax credits has ballooned in the last decade. We're spending $500 million a year on various state tax credits for economic development purposes, and that's out of a general revenue fund of about $7 billion. So nearly 7 or 8% of state revenue is being diverted away from things like schools and prisons and social services needs in order to pay for these projects. Now, I thought it was interesting that Tina said they get a stake in these things. I didn't get a chance to ask her whether they accept patents as collateral, because that's one of the things that happened in the Mamtech situation, was that the bonds were issued on the idea that there was collateral, but the collateral was the patented industrial process that, as I said earlier, the engineers determined wouldn't work.
Right. But at the beginning, it seemed like it might.
Well, it was valued by Mamtech at $92 million, and it was valued by Mamtech's patent attorney at $50 million. And once again, you had a situation where people were accepting Mamtech at face value when they said those things.
What's it like? What has it been like for both of you trying to get information related to this story? Benjamin, maybe you start us off there.
Yeah, just to jump in. It's been a little bit tough, to say the least. Obviously, people don't want to talk about this. Now, part of that is just, you know, when you call someone about a good news story, people are more willing to talk than the bad news story. Naturally, we're human beings, you know, that's the way we work. I do think there's been a lot of, with the either ongoing litigation or soon to be ongoing litigation in this lawyered up world we have, people are kind of afraid to talk about it or think they don't need to talk about it, or their lawyers tell them not to talk about it. I'd say it's been hit and miss. I mean, I want to give a little bit of credit to city officials. I know they feel like their hands are tied by what they can say legally, but they've returned my phone calls. They talked to me. You know, they've provided what information they can. I do feel like as public officials, there should be a higher standard for providing more information. I feel like one of the ways we avoid failed projects like this is to have these discussions out in the open as much as possible. I know business is something, you know, business development is something you kind of have to be careful with there for obvious reasons. But I do feel like the more public discussions are and the more transparent the process is, I wouldn't quite say dissent, but you avoid groupthink that way. And so I think that's one thing to keep in mind to take away from all this is, you know, transparency is good. I think you need to have more voices, a few more cooks in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Rudy, what's your experience been like getting information for this?
I'd say that, Moberly officials have said something when they wanted to say something. They have not been responsive to the idea, okay, I want to interview you and find out the things that I have find out the answers to the things I have questions about. But you know, every so often they would put out a statement that would state what how their progress was working on dealing with it. But the Missouri Department of Economic Development and Governor Nixon's office have been absolutely unwilling to sit down with me or any other media in a calm atmosphere where you're not trying to shout questions at a news conference, where you're not trying to get the detailed questions answered, where you're trying to get philosophical questions. You know, we've gone into a few philosophical things about economic development here today. I'd like to be able to sit down with Jay Nixon and ask him for 45 minutes and ask him specifics about why he was willing to go to Moberly to support this project. I'd also like to know what he thinks the philosophy of Missouri's economic development plan should be. I've asked for interviews with the director of the Department of Economic Development, and that has been equally they've been equally unwilling.
We invited them to come be part of this conversation today, and they declined sending someone.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten to the point where I can send an email to the Department of Economic Development. I may get a 1 or 2 word answer back. But even after the director, David Kerr, had been in the committee room for most of a day, and I had just a couple of questions. In the hallway of the Capitol, he directed my questions to their spokesman, who was standing right beside him. And one of the more frustrating things in a journalist's life is asking a spokesman a question that they have to go then ask someone else for the answer to, and then come back and tell you the answer. And then you go, well, that leads me to this follow-up question. They got to go back. Well, it has become almost impossible to break through the communication people in the Nixon administration and get to the people who are actually doing the work on the front line basis, so that you can ask them what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what philosophy or rules are guiding their work. And I think that a big part of why this was such a big story and why it was so it's been so confusing, especially some of the early stories, was their lack of willingness to talk.
Right? Yeah, barriers between people and their government, not a good thing, I would argue.
Okay, well, that's probably a good place for us to stop because we are out of time. So we'll end on that note. Barriers between people and their government, not a good thing. And we'll thank our guests, Benjamin Harold, city editor of the Moberly Monitor Index, Rudy Keller, a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune, and Tina Hoffman, Marketing and Communications Director for the Iowa Economic Development Authority. Thanks to all three of them for joining us on today's Intersection program. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program. You can also submit your questions and comments and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar and Janet Saidi. Joe Deutschman was today's technical director, with assistance from Karen Clifford. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive producers are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ruben Stern. I'd like to thank you for joining us and hope you have a great week. Take care.